The final investigator I chatted with was Dr. Jean-Yves Douillard, and to begin, I asked him to put in perspective where we are today with systemic treatment of colorectal cancer.
Things have changed a lot because we have now a whole variety of drugs, three drugs mainly in chemotherapy for colon, plus the targeted agents, including bevacizumab, cetuximab, and panitumumab, and additional drugs in development. So with that, including for medical oncologists practicing in a community-based center, there are strategies to define. We can now do one line, two line, three line, four line, and more. So I think the best, when you start with a given patient, is to define your goal. What is your goal? Is it to cure, potentially? Or is this patient definitely uncurable? And we know that in this patient, well, definitely uncurable, we may expect an average median survival of 2 years. And from my point of view, one thing to consider is the quality of life during those 2 years. I hate thinking that the patient will spend the 2 years almost in the hospital. So this is very important. You want to relieve symptoms, and you want the patient to be able to have a decent life. Therefore, the tolerance profile of the drugs that you are going to use is important to consider. To the opposite, if a patient has, let's say, liver-only disease and is potentially resectable, we may get a cure in 30% of those patients with liver-limited disease who are marginally resectable. Then you have to use a more aggressive regimen in order to shrink the tumor and send the patient back to the surgeon.
That kind of ties into a much debated question about whether or not patients who present with resectable hepatic lesions should go directly to surgery or get pre-op chemo. There was the big European study. Where are you right now with that question, and is it being looked at in clinical trials?
Well, based on the clinical trial, and it's mostly the EORTC trial, a patient with a synchronous resectable liver met, in most of the cases, will have perioperative chemotherapy. So we will do 2 months pre-op, then send the patient to the surgeon. And if we have evidence that chemotherapy has been active, either based on the response rate, but also on the pathology analysis of what has been resected, if we have signs of tumor cell destruction, he will receive additional chemotherapy in a pseudo-adjuvant situation. Because for those patients with even resectable disease at diagnosis, the risk of recurrence is very high. Those patients have been presenting with circulating tumor cells, even if we don't document it. They have been in the bloodstream and they have nested into the liver. So we need, from my point of view, to do chemotherapy. Now, we still have to work on that in clinical trials. It's eventually possible that a patient with a single liver metastasis or two liver metastasis well located could be resected up front and receive adjuvant chemotherapy. That we don't know. It's a debate.
What about the selection of preoperative therapy in the patient going for hepatic resection? What chemo, and do you use biologics?
The goal is to get a response, to render this patient resectable. This is what we call the conversion surgery. And in that setting, I would favor a more aggressive approach, including a combination chemotherapy, and my favorite regimen is FOLFIRI, 5-FU irinotecan, plus biologic. Then comes the molecular aspect. You have to know if the patient has a KRAS mutation or not. If there is a KRAS mutation, you are left with bevacizumab. I think bevacizumab with FOLFIRI is increasing response rate. So you have a better chance of resection.
Does that mean if they're KRAS wild, you would use an anti?
If they have KRAS wild type, you may use either bevacizumab or cetuximab or panitumumab. The problem there is the side effects. The side effects of bevacizumab, now that we have experience with it, are very much acceptable. It's mainly blood pressure to be monitored and proteinuria, which is not an issue in most of the cases. So from this point of view, immediate tolerance is better than with the anti-EGFR antibody cetuximab and panitumumab, but you need to wait at least 6 weeks between the last administration of bevacizumab and the surgery to avoid potential bleeding problems or surgical comorbidities. The situation is different with the cetuximab or panitumumab in KRAS wild type, because you can do your last chemotherapy cycle, do a CAT scan, and if the patient is resectable, you can resect the patient within 10 to 15 days.
You talked about the idea of so-called conversion, taking a patient whose surgery is going to be difficult or impossible, treating systemically and rendering them more able to have surgery. What actually is going on in the liver? It kind of has been a little confusing. Is the tumor pulling back from a critical structure? I mean, we know it's not getting sterilized.
No, it's not getting sterilized. There was a nice study that was done in France. I think it's Bernard Nollinger. He went back to patients who had what we would call a clinical complete response. Everything was gone. And he resected the liver despite the fact that there was no lesion. And actually, more than 50% of the patient had a few remaining tumor cells. So I think even if we have a complete response, we should resect.
But what's going on that they become resectable?
If they become resectable?
Yeah, what's happening in the liver that, you know, if it's not getting sterilized, why is it changing the kind of surgery that you can do?
Well, it depends on the location of the metastasis, and you can resect part of the liver. The crucial issue is the volume of the liver that the patient will be left with after surgery. So we can do, from imaging with CT scan or MRI, we can have an idea of the remaining volume of this patient. We can also do a combined approach with resecting what can be resected and doing, for example, a cryo destruction or RFL. We can combine that. We can also, let's say a patient with most of the disease in his right liver, but let's say two nodules in the left liver. So we can resect the two nodules in the left liver, do embolization of the right liver, and the left liver will increase in volume, and in the second step, we resect the right liver. That's done quite often.
You were part of a poster at the GI Cancer Symposium. What is the benefit for patients suffering from metastatic colorectal cancer after bevacizumab-based regimen, cetuximab-based regimen, and panitumumab? Can you comment on that?
What we know is that they will benefit in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival. And if they have symptoms due to their tumor burden, there is quite often symptom relief. Again, we have to take into consideration the KRAS status.
Another question I want to ask you about, maybe flipping over to the earlier side of the disease. I'm kind of thinking about some of the controversial questions out there. Certainly adjuvant therapy for the stage 2 patient has been controversy for a long time. Where are you right now in making that decision, and what's going on in terms of clinical research to help docs make the decision?
Well, let's talk about stage 2 first. There are the low-risk stage 2 and the high-risk stage 2. In the low-risk stage 2, there is no reason to give adjuvant chemotherapy. The benefit is minimal and is not significant. And if it is given, it is generally capecitabine or IV-5-FU, but more often capecitabine. But again, the benefit is non-significant on overall survival, minimum on relapse-free survival, and those drugs have toxicity, and those patients can't go back to work, for example. In the high-risk stage 2, there is no doubt that they should receive adjuvant chemotherapy. The question is, should they receive FOLFOX or should they receive 5-FU only? There is one marker that we could use that is microsatellite instability. because the patients who are so-called MSI high generally have a better prognosis, even though there are some controversy right now from recent data. And they don't benefit from adjuvant 5-FU. They may benefit from Oxali, but Oxali as a single agent has almost no activity. So these cases should be discussed one by one in a multidisciplinary approach, and we have to look for MSI. We have to look at histoprognostic factor, microemboli, a T4 generally have a high risk of recurrence. So it is difficult to give recommendation, and it's really individual patient data that we have to look at to make a decision.
Any comments on the use of genomic predictors? There was a paper looking at Oncotype, which is a different assay.
Gene profiling.
The same gene profiling, similar to what's been done with breast cancer.
Yeah, there are several gene profiles that have been defined. Oncotype is one. The problem is that those gene profiles, based on the technology that is used, are different. It is not standardized yet. It is not really available in routine, but I think this is where the future is. I'm pretty convinced, and this is also true in other diseases. You mentioned breast. There are lots of data in lung cancer, similar. But we have to define a set of genes that has a real prognostic value on which we could base a decision.
Anything else you want to say about colon cancer, new research avenues, areas of interest that oncologists might want to hear about?
At the present time, there are very few new drugs. For chemotherapy, there is no new drug, basically. And in terms of targeted therapies, there is one approach that I'm looking at carefully. It's the glycosylation of anti-EGFR antibodies. Mean that you take the anti-EGFR, you take stuximab, for example, and you bridge on it a sugar radical. There is one drug which is in clinical trial now. It's fucosylated. And those sugars are potent immune stimulant. So if ADCC plays a role, we don't know that cetuximab is doing ADCC in vitro and panitumumab is not because it's a human IgG2. Which is true in vitro. ADCC is an in vitro test. What is the relevance of ADCC in vivo? We don't know. The data are that in patients with mutant KRAS, the use of cetuximab single agent has a 0% response rate. So if ADCC was a relevant mechanism, we should have seen something because it's totally independent of KRAS. We have not seen anything. So I'm looking forward for the results of this trial with the fucosylated anti-EGFR, which we use with FOLFIRI in patient with mutant KRAS. We'll see if it provides something in terms of efficacy.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And again, you know, the fucosylation is not the best way of adding a sugar because some of the more sophisticated sugars are a lot more active in terms of immunostimulation. Galactoseramide, for example, beta-glycan are more active than fucosyl in general. So it's a field that would combine an immune mechanism in addition to targeting the EGFR pathway.
Any thoughts about the issue that, you know, kind of there's been some discussion about in some papers presented in the last couple of years of the patient who presents with a primary colon cancer and metastatic disease where the colon, the primary, is asymptomatic? There's been a lot of debate about that. There have been some presentations of data. How do you approach those patients clinically, and what clinical research data do you think is relevant to that question?
That's a difficult question to answer because if the patient is totally asymptomatic from its primary, and if it's located on the right-sided colon, the risk of obstruction is minimal because the stools are very fluid. If it's on the left-hand side, there is a higher risk of obstruction if the patient does not respond to chemotherapy. So the study you mentioned was probably the one from the Memorial Sloan Kettering,
right,
where 96% of their patients were never resected, which in a sense is good because, you know, if the patient has to go for hemicolectomy, he won't start chemotherapy immediately. It's going to take at least 3 weeks. So again, those patients have to be taken care of by a team individually. If the primary becomes symptomatic under chemotherapy, it's always possible to stop chemotherapy and to do surgery within a week or two. Personally, in my practice, I try not to resect those patients, especially if the tumor is in the right colon.
Do you see responses in the primary?
Yeah, same as in the liver.
Let's talk a little bit about gastroesophageal cancer. Again, looking back over the last couple of years, what's come out that you think docs in practice should know about?
Well, again, more drugs have been evaluated. The most frequently used combination now is called ECX, which is epirubicin, cisplatin, capecitabine. I'm not personally convinced that the epirubicin is needed. It is toxic. However, the median survival remains poor. It's 10 to 12 months, and it has always been around 10 months. So we have not made big progress in gastric cancer. Of course, the standard remains surgery, and the biggest progress that I've been seen is by perioperative chemotherapy before and after resection. But the quality of surgery is essential.
Can you comment on the data that's come out looking at anti-HER therapy, trastuzumab, in gastroesophageal cancer, the so-called TOGA trial?
Yeah, the TOGA trial has shown that for patients who do express or who have a FISH amplification of HER2, they will benefit from adding trastuzumab to chemotherapy. But it's a low number of patients. And there is also a distribution. It's more often expressed on the GI junction rather than in the distal part of the stomach. But for the one, we look for it. We look for HER2 expression in this patient, and we add trastuzumab to chemotherapy.
I mean, you say it's a low number, but I mean, breast cancer, it's 20%, and we talk about it all the time. It seems like it's kind of comparable.
Yeah, it's kind of comparable, but, you know, the incidence of gastric cancer is not as high as breast.
True.
It is still decreasing worldwide because of the refrigerator.
Right. Basically. You know, one of the big debates in breast cancer, and I don't know if we'll ever get the research to even answer this question, as you say, with less patients in gastroesophageal cancer, is whether the anti-HER therapy should be continued indefinitely. In breast cancer, that's what's being done now. How do you approach that in gastroesophageal?
Well, unfortunately, the patient with gastroesophageal cancer that we treat, as I said, will all die in a rather short period of time. But, you know, from an individual patient who would have had a nice response to chemotherapy plus trastuzumab, I would certainly let him under trastuzumab until progression.
Are there any trials out there looking at anti-HER therapy in early stage disease?
Not that I know.
Let's talk a little bit about hepatocellular cancer. What are some of the things that have happened in the last couple of years that you think are important?
Well, sorafenib has been approved in that indication, but as you know, the benefit is really minimal. And it's clearly restricted to patients with type A. The B stages are high risk of toxicity, including bleeding for those patients who have a portal hypertension. So it applies to a limited number of patients. The benefit is not that big. And sunitinib in second line also has a minimal effect, but at least we have something to offer to this patient that quite often have been either resected already or had RFL or even alkalization or whatever local treatment was done. But we had very few data before having the sorafenib trial. We need to find the miracle drug for hepatocellular carcinoma.
How do you approach the question of using a systemic agent like sorafenib as opposed to some of the local modalities like TACE?
Well, TACE is one option. And I think for a patient with liver-limited hepatocellular carcinoma, TACE is a good option. It works. And I would rather save sorafenib for a metastatic disease with extra liver metastasis, which opens now more often than before because with the improvement of the local regional therapies, we have changed the natural history of the disease. I remember when I started practicing 30 years ago, we always said, or we were told, that hepatocellular carcinoma almost never metastasized. It was because the disease control on the liver site was poor. And we have improved that, and now we see patients with hepatocellular carcinoma and lung metastasis, bone metastasis, and so on. So this is the setting where systemic treatment like sorafenib or sunitinib may help a little bit.
Do you integrate systemic therapy like sorafenib between local therapies like TACE? You know, some patients will get 2, 3, or 4 TACE procedures over a period of a year.
No, I've never done that.
How do you approach the dosing of sorafenib?
Well, I start low. I start low and I see the patient every 2 weeks. I go by increasing level based on tolerance. You know, there is always a risk of bleeding if there is even minimal portal hypertension. And sorafenib has side effect, diarrhea, fatigue. Fatigue is very often reported by the patient. So you have to monitor those patients if you want to go up to full dose. I will never prescribe full dose and say, goodbye, come back in 2 months. That would be too dangerous.
What dose do you generally start with?
I start with 200 milligrams twice a day.
What about pancreatic cancer? I was really struck recently. We did a CME series looking at different GI cancers, and the most interest we got was pancreatic cancer, which used to be something people really didn't even want to talk about.
Pancreatic cancer has been very disappointing. So we have shown in France with the FOLFIRINOX triple chemotherapy that we may improve median survival, almost double median survival. But this is not a regimen for everybody. We do have to select patients because it is a toxic regimen.
Yeah, that's really what people are asking about and trying to figure out. How do you approach yourself clinically this question of whether or not to use FOLFIRINOX?
Well, I'm using FOLFIRINOX as often as possible because the benefit on survival is huge.
I mean, can you see that in your own practice, in your patients, though?
Yeah. Response rate is high. So if the patient is in a good performance status, 0 or 1, has not lost too much weight, is not too old, he can probably receive FOLFIRINOX. If not, we still have gemcitabine, which is not satisfactory at all. So it's a question of patient selection. But I think the most interesting approach, and this is being done now in clinical trial, is the use of FOLFIRINOX preoperatively for patients with pancreatic tumor, no metastasis, that quite often are not resectable. Very few of them are resectable. So since the response rate is high, with the tumor shrinkage, more of them will go to surgery. The other way for the one who are resectable up front, very rare, is to do FOLFIRINOX in the adjuvant setting.
Do you do that?
I have done that in one patient because honestly, really the patient that are resectable with pancreatic cancer or zero are very rare.
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever get a study on that.
No.
And how many cycles do you use?
In the neoadjuvant setting?
In the adjuvant setting.
In the adjuvant setting, I tried to do 6 months. But quite often, after 2, 3 cycles, dose adaptation are needed.
In the metastatic setting, what do you actually see clinically in your own practice when you use this regimen in terms of toxicity?
We see the cumulative toxicity of oxaliplatin with neuropathy. Even, you know, they are not treated that long, but they all have neuropathy. And we also see the myelosuppression of combining the three drugs, 5-FU, oxaliplatin, and irinotecan. And there is also more diarrhea. So we have to do dose adaptation, patient education, and so on. And we monitor them very carefully.
Let's talk about rectal cancer.
We have established in Europe that the sequence should be preoperative chemoradiation followed by surgery with a 6 week interval period to let the chemoradiation work, and then eventually adjuvant chemotherapy. So two questions remain. What type of chemo in combination with radiation? Most of the studies that have added oxaliplatin to 5-FU or capecitabine were inconclusive. The pathological complete response rate was a bit higher in most of the studies except one, it was not significant. And a review that was also presented showed that the PCR is not a surrogate endpoint for local regional relapse or survival or distant relapse. So I think the best combination remain now a fluoropyrimidine plus radiation over 5 weeks. Dose of radiation is generally 50 grays. The Nordic countries of Europe are favoring the 5-day radiation, 25 grays, and then immediate surgery the week after. It is not always easy to do because the timing is crucial. And I think it is important for us also to have an idea of the impact of chemoradiation on the tumor itself that you will not see if you operate the week after the end of radiation. So this is why most of the European countries, except Denmark, the Netherlands a little bit, Sweden, we don't do the 5x5 radiation. We do the conventional 50 grays or so in 5 weeks with chemotherapy. We wait for 6 weeks and we resect. And based on the retrospective analysis of the EORTC trial, we know that the patient who actually benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy after resection are the one with the downstaging because they are chemosensitive. So this is one more argument to do the conventional 5-week radiation, wait for 6 weeks, look for downstaging, and then offer adjuvant chemo, 5-FU, in patient who had a downstaging. The other one do not benefit from it.
Adjuvant 5-FU or adjuvant FOLFOX?
That's another question. You know, we work by analogy with colon. The problem is that the staging that we have in colon is a pathological staging. The initial staging we have in rectal is a clinical staging. So we may overstage or understage, even if we used ultrasonography, endoscopy, MRI, PET scan, you are not 100% sure of the initial stage. So what we do actually, and you know, it is debatable, we do pre-therapy clinical staging and post-surgery pathological staging, which is a potential source of error. I am not personally convinced that the addition of oxaliplatin to 5-FU is a major breakthrough in the adjuvant setting of colon and rectal cancer. There was a study presented, a nice pool study of 5 trials that showed that in stage 2, the benefit is 3%, meaning that you have to treat 33 patients and one of them will benefit. Considering the toxicity of oxaliplatin on the long term, this has to be considered. And what would be nice would be to have predictive marker of efficacy. We know we have those, a few of those, like ERCC1, for example, but we don't use it. I have 2 patients that are very angry at me. One is an old lady that I treated 10 years ago now. She liked to play the piano. She's now retired. And each time I see her, she says, well, you destroyed my life with your drug. She's now 10 years away from oxaliplatin, but when she plays the piano after 15 minutes, she had to stop. Another one is a younger guy. Similarly, he's back to work. But he said, after half an hour on my computer, I have to stop. So, you know, the studies say after 2 years, most of the patients do not have neuropathy according to the NCICTC scale. But if you see those patients, just ask them to do it for 5 minutes. And they will feel their finger. So it's, you know, in terms of quality of life again, there is no clear benefit on survival except in stage 3. And again, and I ask the question, he compares stage 2 low risk to stage 2 high risk. He showed the 3% benefit in the high risk. But this has not been done in stage 3, where you have 3A, which is quite often better. If you go to databases like Adjuvant Online or whatever, 3A is quite often better than high risk 3B. and nobody will question the use of FOLFOX in 3A. So they should, in their database, where there are thousands of patients, to 3A, 3B, 3C. I'm pretty convinced that the 3C would benefit from Oxali. I'm not convinced that 3A will, and the 3B will probably be in between.
You mentioned 5-FU. What about the choice of fluoropyrimidine in rectal cancer, both the pre-op and as adjuvant therapy, capecitabine versus 5-FU?
Well, all studies have shown that we can use capecitabine instead of 5-FU, and the outcome is exactly the same.
Is that what you do?
Yeah. Patients prefer that a lot more.
Same thing with colon cancer?
Same thing with colon cancer.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for GI Cancer Update.